Hey everybody, Brian McClanahan here. I've been talking about LearnTrue, T-R-U-E, history.com. You've heard about it several times in the introduction of this podcast. So get on out to LearnTrueHistory.com to get history the way it was intended to be told, with no PC, no Marxism, no progressivism. But not only that, I've got my new How Alexander Hamilton Screwed Up America, my forthcoming book. So I want you to go to LearnTrueHistory.com to sign up for that great program. But also, if you go to blamehamilton.com, you can get in on some giveaways for my forthcoming book. So two websites for you: learntruehistory.com and blamehamilton.com. Get in on both of those things. Learntruehistory.com is the place to go to learn history the way it was intended to be told. Blamehamilton.com is where you learn about how Alexander Hamilton was the greatest villain in American history. This is the Brian McClanahan Show. 3, 2, 1, 0. Welcome back to the Brian McClanahan Show. This is episode 99. Glad to have you back on the program. Glad to be here. Before we get started, just want to remind you that if you do like this podcast, please share it around on social media. You can find me on social media. You can find me on Facebook at Brian McClanahan. You can like me there. You can follow me on Twitter at Brian McClanahan. And you can subscribe to my YouTube page, Brian McClanahan. So just go on out there and search for those things. If you do want to get on my email list, just go to brianmcclanahan.com. Shoot me an email address and I will send you a free ebook, Forgotten Founders in American History, along with the audiobook of the same, read by yours truly. And I'll send you a couple of emails a week or so. Also, if you go to brianmcclanahan.com and you want to help support the Brian McClanahan Show, throw a few pennies my way, you can do so at brianmcclanahan.com/support. And don't forget that the Blame Hamilton promotions are still ongoing for my forthcoming How Alexander Hamilton Screwed Up America. You can go to blamehamilton.com. You'll get all the details there. Essentially, it's pretty easy. You pre-order one book. It can be ebook or hardback format. And I will send you an ebook. It is the Jeffersonian Solution. If you pre-order two or more books, and it can be a mix match, it can be one ebook and one hardback book, or two hardback books or more, it's two or more, you'll not only get the Jeffersonian Solution, but you'll also get a 6-lecture course on Alexander Hamilton. So go on out there and do that. It's a great deal. And of course, all those things expire on September 18th. And everyone who enters the promotion, pre-orders a book, you are entered for the grand prize, which is a master-level membership to libertyclassroom.com. So go on out there and do that. Even if you are a master-level member already, as the details tell you in the contest, if you're already a master-level member and you are selected for the grand prize, you get a gift card to Amazon. So you still a win-win. You still possibly can get a gift out of pre-ordering the book. So, and of course, the first gift is the ebook, and then if you order two or more, you get that 6-lecture course on Hamilton. So you get something from the beginning, even if you don't win the grand prize, second prize, or third prize. So it's a great opportunity, and again, it all ends on September 18th when the book comes out. That's only a little over a month away now, so you don't want to miss out on this. Get in there while you still can and get that deal. Okay, well, today is kind of a user-generated podcast. We're on the cusp of the 100th Brian McClanahan Show, which will be next week, and I'm going to do a different talk on that day, on the 100th episode. But this was one that somebody had asked me to do months ago, and I didn't do it. And I thought, well, let me go ahead and do a short podcast on this, because I also have some designs to do this in a larger format. But I thought maybe one podcast on it would be a good podcast, something to bide the time when I get to the bigger project on this particular issue. But I thought that this would be something that's actually kind of relevant. Looking at the news, we, of course, have got a couple of major networks, HBO and then also Amazon in their streaming service, are going to produce shows dealing with an alternate universe where the Confederacy won. And so I thought that this particular issue would speak to that, because there was a piece that just came out in the Federalist, I think it was today, and it was talking about how The Confederacy was the, let me see what date this was. Yeah, it was today, the 3rd. It was talking about how the Confederacy and John C. Calhoun were actually the precursors to the modern progressive state. Now, that's an interesting argument in some ways, but the author gets it all wrong. However, I think that when you look at the Confederate government and you look at their Constitution, and people have said, well, you know, the only difference between the Confederate Constitution and the U.S. Constitution is slavery, it's completely wrong. So what I'm going to talk about today is the Confederate Constitution, what it was, how it's an important part of the American constitutional tradition, what are the major differences, and explain some of the provisions of the Constitution. And I think when you look at the American constitutional tradition, you talk about American constitutionalism, you have to not only look at the U.S. Constitution, but you also have to consider the Articles of Confederation, you have to consider the Confederate Constitution, you have to consider all the state constitutions, because that is, in the larger context, part of the American constitutional tradition. So, unfortunately, all we ever do is when we're going to take a class on the Constitution. It's the Constitution. That's it. And that's all we're going to study. The Articles of Confederation are going to be bashed as being worthless and outdated. No one's going to mention the Confederate Constitution. And the state constitutions are just these stupid little things that are subservient to the central authority. So, that's all wrong. All of these things are part of the American constitutional tradition. In fact, you know, in 1829... the state of Virginia had a constitutional convention amending their constitution, or actually writing a new constitution, and it was attended by some of the best minds of the day. This was just as prestigious as the U.S. Constitutional, or the Philadelphia Convention there in 1787 in so many ways. I mean, you're looking at some of the best minds in the entire United States, and they were in Virginia at the time. So when you look at the American constitutional tradition, you have to consider these other documents. And first and foremost in that, in many ways, is the Confederate Constitution, because the Confederate Constitution was an outgrowth of the problems that had been ongoing in the United States since 1788 and 1789, really 1789, since the first Congress took its seats. And, of course, the Washington administration Washington was inaugurated, and, of course, you had this first government under the Constitution. So, when you look at this Constitution, you can't look at it in a vacuum and say, well, this is just the Confederate Constitution. The only thing that they were concerned about was slavery. Well, I think when you read the Constitution, it becomes very clear there were other issues that were on their mind besides the institution of slavery. And I can make a point that the Confederate Constitution was no more of a slave-holding, pro-slavery document than the U.S. Constitution. In fact, the shift in language was, of course, noticeable. They actually called slaves in the Confederate Constitution. But they did prohibit the importation of slaves. They prohibited the international slave trade. They actually prohibited, or at least allowed the Congress to prohibit, the importation of slaves from the United States. So if Virginia, for example, stayed in the Union, which it was in February of 1861 when this Constitution was written, then, or North Carolina, or Tennessee, then, for example, then those slaves would not be allowed to be imported from those states. Also, it allowed the Three-Fifths Compromise, the state in the Constitution. People, why'd they do that? Well, this gave states like South Carolina and Mississippi larger representation because slave population and the free black population of those states was larger than the white population, so it gave those states a larger representation in the government. There are, and of course they talked about that there was the Fugitive Slave Clause. I mean, all that stuff was in there. It's just there's really not a whole lot of difference between those clauses and the U.S. Constitution. They did say in the Confederate Constitution that if the Confederacy acquired territory, then slavery was legal in that territory. That was one major difference. And of course, so when I've talked about on this particular podcast before, why slavery? Well, there you have it, you see. It was all about the Western territories. But it did not say that states could not abolish slavery. And it did not say that non-slaveholding states were prohibited from joining the Union. That's not part of it at all. So you could have had, for example, Illinois join the Confederacy as a non-slaveholding state. It's just that slavery was going to be allowed to go to be extended into the territories. But those territories could become free states if they chose to do so. So this cop-out that, well, it's all about slavery in the Constitution, it's a cop-out. People that say that have never read it. They don't know what's in it. They don't really understand the Confederate Constitution. They don't view it as part of the American constitutional experience. They're just stupid. But let's get to the differences, and I think some of the major differences between the Confederate Constitution and the U.S. Constitution. And you can find that their view of government, and this is clear, that their view of government was that of, say, the real Federalists in 1788. What I mean by that is these are the proponents of the Constitution. What you look at in this document, people say, well, it's part of the anti-Federalist tradition. No, it's part of the Federalist tradition in terms of real Federalists, people that wanted a real federal government. Of course, this was ratified in March of 1861 before we had, and of course, the Provisional Constitution put in place, and then this Constitution, March of 1861, before we had the secession of the Upper South states. That hadn't happened yet. Because Lincoln had not sent in 75,000 troops to put down the quote-unquote rebellion. So, when you look at this document, it's part of that proponent, friends of the Constitution. They would have recognized some things about this document, because it's exactly how they argued the Constitution would be interpreted when it was going through the ratification process. That is the key to understanding the Constitution. And I just did Mises Weekend a couple of weekends ago, and I brought this up. And of course, if you've taken the Constitution course at learntruehistory.com, which is my affiliate link for Liberty Classroom, but if you want to subscribe to Liberty Classroom, please go to learntruehistory.com and subscribe there. We talk about this. Dr. Gutzman and I both talk about this, that the Friends of the Constitution sold the document to the states in a way that they would recognize the Confederate Constitution, because a lot of the stuff is there. Now, there are some important innovations and changes in this document, and I think that looking at the American constitutional tradition, we should think about these things and how we could make the U.S. Constitution better. It's not infallible, as some people would think. It can be made better. But first and foremost, you start with the preamble. There's a difference between the preamble to the U.S. Constitution and a difference between the preamble to the Confederate Constitution. The Confederate Constitution preamble states this: "We, the people of the Confederate States, each state acting in its sovereign and independent character, in order to form a more permanent federal government, establish justice, ensure domestic tranquility, and secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, invoking the favor and guidance of Almighty God, do ordain and establish this Constitution for the Confederate States of America." So from the beginning, there was a lot of questions about, well, did we the people of the United States, did that mean an amorphous mass of people form the government? Well, here it's very clear. We the people of the Confederate States, each state acting in its sovereign independent character. So the states are central to the preamble. The states are central to the document. From the beginning, it's clear that the states are sovereign and independent, just as they were in 1788 when the Constitution was ratified. In fact, the early drafts of the Constitution listed the states, we the people of the states of, and of course that was dropped because no one knew who was going to ratify this document and who wouldn't. Here, at this point, no one knows who's going to be joining the Confederate States. And they're forming not a union, but a permanent federal government. Okay. There's a key there. If you're forming a permanent federal government, that means that the states could leave that permanent. The federal government does not cease to exist if the states leave it. A union, in order to form a perfect union, that implies, or at least the misconstruction of that says that, well, this union cannot be broken. Now, of course, I could argue against that all day long, and I think win that argument. But they're forming a permanent federal government. It does not mean that government, you cannot leave that government, because each state is acting in its sovereign and independent character. Okay? So that is one. Of course, and also, They actually use God in the preamble and expressly state that. Now, the structure of the Constitution in terms of articles is exactly the same. There are seven articles. And there are some additions to these articles. Essentially, what they did is they incorporated the Bill of Rights into the Constitution itself. But they did make some changes that I think are important to note. First, Article 1, Section 1, all legislative powers herein delegated shall be vested in a Congress of the Confederate States. So they're delegated by the states. Now, I can make the case, and I have on this podcast where I did the podcast, I Grant You the Power, what that granting actually means. A granted power can be rescinded, but also when you say you're delegating, you're taking that language from what is the 10th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution, and you're putting it into the document itself. So you are trying to eliminate any misconstruction from the beginning. And then, essentially, Article 1, Section 1 is fairly, it's pretty much the same. Otherwise, Section 3 is pretty much the same. When you get down to Section 8, let me backtrack here. Section 7 of the Confederate Constitution. This is an important innovation that they added to this Constitution. Article 1, Section 7, which has also in the U.S. Constitution contains what's often called the veto power. Article 1, Section 7 has this. It has the ability for the President of the Confederate States to veto a bill, but it also adds what we today call a line item veto. So Article 1, Section 7 of the Confederate Constitution says this. The president may approve any appropriation and disapprove any other appropriation in the same bill. In such case, he shall, in signing the bill, designate the appropriations disapproved and shall return a copy of such approbations with his objections to the house in which the bill shall have originated, and the same proceedings shall then be had as in the case of other bills disapproved by the president. So you have to go through the override process. This is a line item veto, and of course, in the 1990s, the U.S. Congress passed a line item veto, and that was declared unconstitutional, and rightly so, because you should have to amend the Constitution to get it. So what presidents in the United States now have done is they issue signing statements. I don't agree with this, I don't agree with that. They're trying to do an end around unconstitutionally and line item veto. I mean, I think this is a great innovation. We should do it, but it requires a constitutional amendment. And in my Nine Presidents Who Screwed Up America, I talk about the ability of the president to have a line item veto. It would be something that would be, I think, a good part of good power for the president to have, because you would be able to cut the fat. You wouldn't have these omnibus bills. You wouldn't have the Congress say, well, in order to get this, this, and this, you got to add this in, and the president has to accept it. Even when there's about 1,000 unconstitutional things in a bill, you could just line item veto all those things out if you had a real principled president. And I think that would be the case, that could happen. Now, of course, the president is going to use these as partisan hammer at time. Well, I'm just going to veto these things. I don't like them. But this would be a great power. The Confederate Constitution had it. So there's one very important innovation that I think that when you look at the Confederate States of America and you look at some of the things that they had done in their Constitution, this was a very good and beneficial innovation. And then you get to Article 1, Section 8. The Congress shall have power. And then they list out. Now here's the first clue that it wasn't just slavery that the... Well, at least in powers of Congress. I already talked about the clue in the preamble and then and that phrase delegated and granted. But here's a clue that there were several other issues going on in the U.S. Congress besides the issue of slavery, long-standing issues. So here we go. Section 8, Article 1, Section 8, Clause 1. To lay and collect taxes, duties, imposts, and excises for revenue necessary to pay the debts, provide for the common defense, and carry on the government of the Confederate States. But no bounty shall be granted from the Treasury, nor shall any duties or taxes on importations from foreign nations be laid to promote or foster any branch of industry. And all duties, imposts, and excises shall be uniform throughout the Confederate States. So, in other words, the Confederate States of America prohibited what we call protective tariffs. There could be a revenue-producing tariff. It says so. to lay and collect taxes, duties, imposts, and excises for revenue necessary to pay the debts, provide for the common defense, and carry on the government of the Confederate States. They took out the general welfare clause because everyone understood that the general welfare in 1788 meant that the general welfare of the Union could carry on the government. But of course, that was distorted. So they took out the general welfare clause and they made it clear, codified it, that you could not have a protective tariff. So that's important. That's an important designation to make. So here we go. The Southerners had fought for years that protective tariffs were unconstitutional, and they were told all the time, no, these things are perfectly constitutional. They're perfectly constitutional. Now, Article 1, Section 8, Clause 3. To regulate commerce with foreign nations and among the several states and with the Indian tribes. But neither this nor any clause contained in this Constitution shall ever be construed to delegate the power to Congress to appropriate money for any internal improvement intended to facilitate commerce. So here we have a express prohibition on federally funded internal improvements. Again, an issue, a hot-button issue for Southerners for years. But of course, all those were just unimportant. I mean, if you read the mainstream historians, these issues were just, nobody was talking about that stuff. No one was. I mean, obviously, because they didn't put it in the Confederate Constitution. No one talked about these things ever. I mean, this stuff was just completely silent. The only thing anyone ever talked about was slavery. Slavery, I mean, look, anytime a Southerner spoke in the Congress, if you go back, this is what you would think. The first word out of their mouth was, I rise today to speak about slavery. Because slavery and slavery and slavery and slavery and slavery. Oh, and by the way, slavery. Because all I worry about is slavery. So I'd like to conclude my remarks with slavery and slavery, slavery, slavery. Thank you. This is what you would think people said from the South all the way through the antebellum period. It's like the Charlie Brown thing. Wah, 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 wah. But it wasn't wah, wah. It was slavery. Slavery, 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 slavery. This is what, and I think that when people go out, they have like, the, you know, you see the horses with the blinders on the side and they can't see anything else. And they just, they make every word say slavery. But of course, if you read the Confederate Constitution, it's clear that they didn't think about anything else. I mean, it's all just about slavery. Oh yeah, that's why they changed. Made some very important changes to Article 1, Section 8, which is really the most important article in the entire Constitution, the important section of the most important article in the entire Constitution. Now, here's another important innovation. Article 1, Section 8, Clause 7, to establish post offices and post routes, not roads, routes, where the post office can go. And this is what everyone thought that meant originally in 1788, but now, no. A road can be any road. Any road. You can have any road. But also, not only could it not establish roads, but routes. The post office can drive here or, you know, have their carriages here and walk here. But the expenses of the post office department after the first day of March in the year of our Lord, 1863, shall be paid out of its own revenue. So the post office has to be self-sufficient. Wow. That's a novel thing. No way. You couldn't have a post office that's just sucking money up all the time? There's no way. I actually had a boss one time and asked me, we were standing in the post office when I worked for this company and it was in sales. And we had to go mail stuff every week. And so you'd always go to the post office and you'd have these big envelopes of stuff to mail out for your reports for the week. And we were standing in line. There was one lane open, line out to the door. And he says very loud, "Hey, why did they raise the price of stamps?" And everyone kind of looks around like, "I don't know why." And he says, "So they can have more next window, please signs. You know, so this is why they do it, so they can have less service." And of course, the people behind that got very cranky about that. But it was hilarious, right? So the post office has to be self-sufficient. Article 1, Section 8, Clause 9, to constitute tribunals inferior to the Supreme Court. This was allowed, but they never did it. That's the other thing. Before I meant to mention, 1991 or 1992, Marshall DeRosa published a great book on the Confederate Constitution. It's entitled The Confederate Constitution, I think, is the title of the book. But just look up Marshall DeRosa. He's got a book that he's going to come out with at some point. It goes through Confederate case law. A fantastic idea. He went back through, looked at all the courts, and wrote a book. He's written a book on Confederate case law. Just fantastic. But they never actually... they never put the Supreme Court into effect. They just used the state courts, which is amazing. So those are some important differences in Article 1, Section 8. And they left the necessary and proper clause, and I've had somebody say, well, yeah, the Confederacy wasn't worried about implied powers because they left the necessary and proper clause and the supremacy clause in the Constitution. This is true. They did. Why? Because they didn't have to worry about misconstruction or abuse because they expressly stated in the document that the states were sovereign and central to the document, that these certain things that they had always had a problem with were prohibited, and they put what we have, the Tenth Amendment, into the document to say, if it doesn't say you can do it, you can't do it. So the Necessary and Proper Clause was harmless in the Confederate Constitution. Now, it also allowed, Article 1, Section 9, it also allowed export taxes in a two-thirds majority vote. So that was an interesting difference. So you could not have a protective tariff, but you could have an export tax, because remember, the Confederacy is an exporting nation, essentially, and so exporting union, I should say. And so having an export tax, if two-thirds of the states agreed, might have been important. Now... as I said, they actually incorporated the Bill of Rights into the document. But it was clear that these things did not apply to the states. Because Congress, it says, this is in Article 1, Section 9. It's a prohibition on Congress, not the states. That's also an important distinction to make. So, we get people all the time say, well, the 14th Amendment is great because it prohibits the states from doing these things, and we got to have this national... incorporation is a disaster. But what they did here, these restrictions are only on Congress. Congress shall make no law respecting the establishment of religion and prohibiting the free exercise thereof, etc., etc. Congress cannot infringe on the right of the people to keep and bear arms. Congress cannot quarter soldiers in a house without the consent of the owner in time of peace. Congress cannot violate what we consider Fourth Amendment rights, or Fifth Amendment rights, or Eighth Amendment rights. Because Section 10 is very clear, those are prohibitions on the states. So, Article 1, Section 9 are prohibitions on congressional power only, not state power. Because Article 1, Section 10 is very clear, these are the prohibitions on state power. So, it's important to note the distinctions there. Now, another important innovation, Article 2, the President in the Confederate States of America had a non-renewing six-year term. He was not eligible to run for another term. So you got a six-year term, and that's it. That's it. So no chance of having to go out and campaign again for another four years. President gets one term, that's all. And that was an important distinction to make. Also, Article 3, again, the Congress never established the Supreme Court of the Confederate States. It didn't. It just said, we don't need it. We have the state courts, and so that was that. those are some of the important things. Now, again, you get down to Article 6. Article 6 does contain the Supremacy Clause. Article 6, Section 3, or I should say Clause 3. This Constitution and the laws of the Confederate States made in pursuance thereof, and all treaties made, or which shall be made, under the authority of the Confederate States, shall be the supreme law of the land. But also in Article 6, it includes these two additional clauses. Clause 5. The enumeration in the Constitution of certain rights shall not be construed to deny or disparage others retained by the people of the several states. In other words, there's your Ninth Amendment, and then, lo and behold, right after that, the powers not delegated to the Confederate States by the Constitution, or prohibited by it to the states, or reserved to the states respectfully, or to the people thereof. So there is your Tenth Amendment in the document itself. In the document itself, right there. So, clearly, the only thing on the mind of these people, and they when they convened in Montgomery to draft a Constitution, was slavery. I mean, that, and I've seen it. You go back and you read the debates there, and they just, it's all one word. It's like insanity, right? It's Jack Nicholson writing, all work and no play makes Jack a dull boy, because the only thing you see is slavery. That's the whole word. They didn't talk about anything else. Nobody. Eric Foner, I mean, he definitively said this when the judge was on TV in the Jon Stewart show. No, all he ever talked about was slavery. That's it. That's all anybody talked about, slavery. And as these delegates stand up, I'd like to rise today and speak about slavery, because slavery. Clearly, this is the whole document. It just says slavery all down it. There's no differences. It's just slavery. I mean, this is how stupid and shallow these people are that talk about these things. And then, of course, then you have the argument come back, yeah, well, they might have said all this, but they had a heavy-handed government, and they suppressed civil liberties, and they had a draft, and all. Yeah, the Confederate States was not perfect, certainly. But you did have people saying, even in the United States government, saying, look, the Confederate Constitution is much more even-handed on these things than the United States government was. So, and this is where I think Marshall DeRosa's forthcoming book will be really interesting on Confederate case law at the time, because it'll get into a lot of those issues. But you have to understand the Confederate Constitution as part of the American constitutional tradition. If you don't, then you're missing a whole entire part of American constitutionalism. Because essentially, as I said, the Friends of the Constitution in 1788 would recognize this document and say, well, yeah, this is really what we meant. This is not an anti-federal document. It's a federal document, as it says in the preamble, to form a more permanent federal government. And what is a federal government? It's the same thing as a confederal government. It's a union of states. It's a federal republic. So understand the Confederate Constitution is key to understanding the U.S. Constitution, or at least the original intent of the U.S. Constitution, because that's exactly what we got in 1861 with the Confederate Constitution. So as I said, this podcast is briefly, you know, a discussion of some bigger issues that I'm going to get into in the future. I don't know exactly when, but it's going to be part of a bigger project. So look for that, because you're going to want to get onto that. But I hope you enjoyed it, and I'll see you next time on the Brian McClanahan Show for episode 100. So again, it's going to be an interesting topic that day. I'll see you next week.